buildings were actually picked up and carted away. And now they survive as images on fridge magnets.
But at any given venue, there's a few locals that don't seem to need to buy a ticket.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton. Today we're going on a journey through small towns across the country. A bit later in the show, we'll be travelling down the Great Southern Rail to a little town called Cook in South Australia that's actually more of a train station, really. Then we'll be visiting Bellingen, a hippie haven in an otherwise conservative countryside. But we're starting things in the playground of a tiny school in a very small New South Wales town called Jerangle.
Good work, Ben. You did really well. Thumbs up.
Jerangle is a farming town in the Snowy Mountains in New South Wales. Less than 300 people technically live there. The nearest big town is Cooma, which is about 60 kilometres away, and half of that is dirt road.
I've been now at Jerangle for about 7 years, and it's still as fabulous as it was the day I walked in here.
Sonia Sim is a teacher at Jerangle Public. Actually, she's the only teacher.
So I'm the principal as well as the teacher, and along with that is also the first aid officer and the canteen officer and the playground duty officer and many, many other hats that you have to wear during the course of the day.
Jerangle Public is what's known as a small school. Pretty self-explanatory, the school has only 11 students spread from kindy to year 6 and all in the one classroom. Sonia started her teaching career at a school of over 800 students before moving to Cooma 7 years ago. And after a few casual teaching roles around the place, she saw the job advertised at Jerangle Public, 60 k's down the road.
So I looked it up on the map and I thought, wow, that looks like a pretty awesome way out place. And I applied for it and was able to get it. So it was a little bit of a shock for me because I came really from a school from 800 and I had 6 little people in my class.
What's your name, Paul, right?
So basically what happens is when the bus arrives, and we do have like a little mini bus that collects all the kids from their farms and drops them here at 9 o'clock, I'm basically on duty from then until 3 o'clock when the bus picks them up again. Which sounds to other teachers who have times in the staff room when they can go and have a bit of a chill out, don't know, wow, how can you do that? But the kids are great. Being in playground duty both at recess and at lunchtime is really quite rewarding, and you're able to get to know the kids a little bit more. In fact, it's not been uncommon for me to be out there on the cricket field pitching a few balls to the boys, or jumping around on skipping ropes, even playing in the sandpit with the kindies. So it's yeah, really, really enjoyable to be part of that school community from 9 o'clock till 3 o'clock when the school day is on.
Okay, next one.
But it can be sort of a bit of a mind-boggling idea of how can you teach a kindergarten student while you're also teaching a year 6 student. And the answer is that they can become very independent in their learning. And we're able to set tasks, explain tasks, do a teaching, and then set the children on to do that while the teacher is then explaining something else to another grade. And it works very well. The children are very independent, and they're good workers, and they enjoy learning, which is a delight to be in the classroom. It's pretty hectic at times, and you wonder if you even stopped during the day, but it's also very rewarding. I've just enjoyed being part of the school and part of seeing the children grow up.
The size of Jerangle Public isn't the only thing that makes it unusual. As a landmark for the town amid sheep farming country, the view from the playground is pretty unique too.
A little bit of a bitumen road here. They've just bitumen the dirt road in front of the school, but it is surrounded by paddocks, and the farmers use the road for moving sheep and cattle around the paddocks, And one morning I was sitting with morning tea with the children, and all of a sudden I heard some bleating, and I, what's all that about? What's the commotion? And there was probably 1,000 sheep walking past the school gates, moving to another paddock. And behind that was not motorbikes, not cars, not trucks, but just a person, one person walking with a stick and 3 dogs. And I just thought it was such a beautiful scene that I'll always treasure that memory of having the sheep going past the school. And I thought, not many schools can say that their front yard is a thoroughfare for livestock going backwards and forwards just as a lovely, lovely pace.
For some people, the idea of being the only teacher in this kind of classroom would be pretty challenging. But a network of other small schools in the area and the support of the Durango community keeps Sonia from feeling alone or isolated. Next year, the school is celebrating 125 years of Durango Public, and the whole community has come together to plan the celebration, even parents who they themselves went to Durango Public when they were kids.
It's amazing that a one-teacher school in a rural community can be supported by the community for that long. Yeah, the fabric of the community is probably the strongest thing. Because the buildings aren't here, the people make up for it, and their strength is in helping each other. Seeing as we're fairly isolated from major towns, the people are very reliant on each other and to help each other out in times of need, and also in times of celebrations. And they certainly do know how to celebrate and enjoy life.
There are so many tiny communities around Australia with unique stories to tell that you may never get to know, because there's just so much distance between them. And nothing illustrates this better than the Great Southern Rail. Australia actually has the longest stretch of rail in the world. It tracks through thinly spread small towns across the wide desert from Perth to Sydney, 4 days, 3 nights, 4,000 kilometres all up. Producer James Pirtle hopped on in Kalgoorlie and rode all the way up to Sydney, and we're joining him halfway in the small town of Cook, South Australia.
People have just started getting off the trains and they're wandering around. They look a little bit aimless and lost. There's this massive train that dominates the town, and you can only imagine what it's like when it's gone and you're just surrounded by this perfectly flat landscape. And all about here there's a tennis court over there, there's an old golf course, there's a pool, all these remains of an Australian suburb. But in the middle of the desert, and now it's completely gone to ruin, and there's only about 6 people living permanently in this town. There used to be about 300.
Come in.
Thank you.
Yeah, come and have a look if you like.
Yeah, just isn't it?
Yeah, the old buildings. The hospital, they've no longer got the building up. We've got the school up, the double-storey building.
Oh, that, yes.
That's still up. If you walk to the end of the street, you've got a picture of it here. You've got a plaque. I've got a fridge magnet, what the hospital used to look like.
That's the woman who runs the shop in Cook, and she's one of the 6 people who live in the town.
This is my hubby.
He's the main, the guys are the main caretakers. Us girls are regarded as cleaners, so we clean the dongas for the tractor and drivers.
And I'm talking to them because the Indian Pacific has stopped to refuel, and that's why Cook is here. It's a diesel pump, basically, in the centre of the desert. It's the only scheduled stop between Kalgoorlie and Adelaide. And in many ways, it's the ultimate railway town. It exists only for trains. It was built in 1917 to supply coal and water for the steam engines crossing on the new Trans-Australia line. But in 1997, the railway was privatised and the new owners thought they did not need a support town there. So the buildings were actually picked up and carted away. And now they survive in Cook, as images on fridge magnets that you can buy down at the curio shop.
Yeah, we'll be here a while. Come in, sir. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Well, so, would you get many people passing
passing through. You know, this time of year, actually, the tourists...
I was taking the train from Kalgoorlie to Sydney, the Indian Pacific. It's 4 days and three nights, and that's about 2.5 thousand miles. And you go through the desert, through the Nullarbor Desert.
You are now also travelling on at the longest straight stretch of rail anywhere in the world, ladies and gentlemen.
I was in red class, which is the cheap seats. You had to fall asleep in the chair, there was no bed. You just lie there listening to the rattling and the shunting of 29 train carriages. You know, the metal couplings and the clatter of the tonnage on the steel rails and the concrete sleepers. And then the first morning out of Kalgoorlie, you wake and you see the desert rushing past the window and the sunrise. Looks like a hangover is happening to the planet.
They're deep, yeah. And they're very hard to define because they're all it's just a hole in the ground.
So it could just be flat, 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 flat. You don't see anything, then this is a hole.
Yeah, we've missed quite a few.
Yeah.
But, unless you know exactly where they are, because you can't see them from any distance until you're right on top of them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's one part of it too, it's like a cathedral. You actually walk straight down into it and the birds in there.
Do you know the maps we've got? They're all hand-drawn.
Yeah.
You know, because people have just found them, especially the freight train drivers. Some of them have been with the company or as train drivers for over 30 years, so they've gotten to know the surroundings. And we just talk to them and they're so good. They've actually seen
the town as a boom and then just dwindled away. You know?
These days it's much, much cheaper to fly across the continent than to even take the cheapest seat on the train, even red class. Flying is quicker and there's movies, it's comfortable. There's always this fear of being left behind, lost in empty space. There's also our fascination with people who've gone and lost themselves and lived in the desert.
There was an old gentleman called Ziggy. He used to work for the Great Southern Railways.
What are you seeing there, Margaret?
It's a dog. Look, a black dog.
Oh, yeah. And there's white ones there too.
They're probably dingoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he worked for the Great Southern Railways. He was a ganger, putting the railway line down for the Indian Pacific. And he built his own little shack on the side here. And he lived there for many, many years. And the Indian Pacific used to stop or slow down and throw out a big tin of Milo for him. He loved his Milo. And he had a lot of dogs, a lot of animals. He lived off the land as well. And he eventually got very sick and they put him in a home because they thought all those dogs and the dingoes out there, if he died, they might eat him, you know. But
His shack is still there?
Yes.
You might pass the shack?
Oh yeah, you will. It's just an old rambling shack, that's all.
Is it around Cook sort of area? Trains were the Industrial Revolution. They spread from England and across the earth. The colonies of Australia, of course, had railways when they federated, but they didn't have anything to link the east to the west. So they came up with this idea of building this Trans-Australia Railway, and work began in 1912, shortly before Gallipoli. It took survey teams months to cross the 1,000 miles that they needed to cover. And they were working with teams of 80 camels each from separate ends, from Kalgoorlie and from Port Augusta. The men were living in tents made of canvas bags sewn together. And they drank this horrible moonshine concoction called bluebush juice, which was made from like methylated spirits and boot polish. And that's how they lived. That's how they built the rails. They really lived like dogs.
But then what they class as tough and what we call tough are two different things.
Standards,
yeah.
That's Val and Jeff from Country Victoria. And Val and Jeff were worried about the future of their town, Uchuka. They said there were fewer jobs in cattle and in forestry. And we talked about Cook, about its swimming pool full of sand and its gutted houses. And they said that's what they fear will happen to their own town.
We've got issues back at home with national parks and things, so...
Oh, okay, land being sort of set aside for that sort of...
Oh, the local Red Gum Forest has been turned into a national park.
Okay.
And so they've...
We disagreed about the environment, but out here in the desert, it was like our arguing was just a way of huddling together against the empty space. And the metal train with its dining car, its showers, its no smoking signs, its curtains and porters, its red class and gold class and platinum service. This procession of Australian society with its sausage rolls and Chardonnay shot through the interior.
He just had his 70th, Barney. My name's Paul McCormick, and I call Orange. But he's just had his 70th, and his kids bought him a present to go to Darwin. But anyway, we're on the Indian Pacific now, back to Orange. Thank God, the gateway to the West, Orange. But
meet Barney and Paul, lifelong mates, good old boys. Barney was a greenskeeper in Parkes, and Paul had worked all his life in the Electrolux factory in Orange.
I worked there all my life, yeah. I love that joint.
And what's happening to the factory now?
Like every other industry, overseas, moving it out. They can't compete with other countries as far as making refrigerators go. They just go offshore.
Were you saying that used to make all the Westinghouse refrigerators in Australia?
Every refrigerator and every part of the refrigerator was made in Orange. Yeah, New South Wales was, yeah, it was the strong point of the state, you could say. Yeah, but they done everything there, everything. Now they import everything.
When we were young, we could get a train from Sydney Parkes every day. Now, from where I'm living at Parkes, you can only get a train once to Sydney, one day a week. But they went throughout New South Wales, so I presume they were in South Australia and other states.
I used to catch the train to go to the football in Sydney in the late 50s, early 60s. I'm a St George supporter. Actually, we lost one of our better players just recently, bloody Reg Gasnier.
Oh, yeah.
He was the prince of them all.
The 60-year-old train on the 100-year-old rails created its own world, a place of nostalgia populated by folk heroes. In this Australia, manufacturing was still mighty, and the dollar was fixed, and we would always be making Holdens.
Apparently, when the train company bought the town out, they just scooped all the cars up and buried them.
In our tip?
In our pit.
Really? So, it's all the stuff under the ground that no one knows about.
So we have to drive away to go and see.
Going to Cook, it seems like you've come to a place where one part of Australia came to a grinding halt, derailed. It's a place of ghosts, of things that were once new and exciting and laminated. It's Australia, but it's nothing like Australia. It's not recognisable.
I don't want to miss the train.
And there's a fear that you'll be trapped there, as in a foreign country.
That story was by James Pirtle and was originally featured on our show in July 2014. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we're visiting small towns around Australia. Our next story takes us up the New South Wales coast and into conservative country heartland. But not in the way you might expect.
I creep through Maxville and burn off three trucks in Nambucca as I race for the turn off to the waterfall way. Where may I always stay? There the hills are greener than Galway's, the rivers run cleaner than Antarctic ice, and the mountains burn purple in the dark of night.
When I left Melbourne to go work on the mid-north coast of New South Wales 6 months ago, I didn't expect to find a little piece of the city there waiting for me. I'd been prepared for an area full of retirement villages, conservative politics, and towns struggling having been bypassed by the highway. And yet, here I am, walking through a small town practically the opposite of all of that, surrounded by people of all ages making art, music, and bohemian culture. There are buskers playing pirate folk music on the street corner, Whole Foods stores, alternative therapy houses and bookshops, and calls to support renewable energy and oppose logging in the nearby forest are in every shop window. Welcome to Bellingen, a town of 5,020 kilometres off the Pacific Highway, not far south of Coffs Harbour, that is different and proud of it.
It's a matter of pride. No golden arches or KFC, Pizza Hut or CCTV. As for Coles, Woolies and department stores, that's what Coffs Harbour and Nambucca are for.
Ross McClay moved to this area in the 80s and is interested in the history of the Bellinger Valley. The Bellinger is the name of the river that runs through Bellingen. It was meant to have the same name as the town, but the person who first drafted a map of the area mistook the surveyor's final handwritten N in the word as an R, and the name stuck. Ross tells me, a bit like Byron Bay, Bellingen got its bohemian edge after the local timber and dairy industries faded and artsy alternative types from urban areas moved in their place.
I know people that came here in the 60s, like there started to be a bohemian movement in a way in the 60s of painters and things like that, and they were really odd in the town, but they found sort of a sympathy often. Certainly the friends of mine that came in that time found a kind of commonality of spirit. They had things that they shared with local people here, or at least an understanding of these struggling, impoverished ways that were quite common in this area.
I've also heard weed growers and smokers moved into the valley when those other industries started to disappear, and this alternative revenue stream helped underpin the local economy for a number of years. Well, that's what I've heard.
People who grow it. You know what I mean? And barely a cop to be seen. Everything's green in Bello.
While this hippie influx helps explain Bellingen's uniquely alternative character, it's worth noting the newcomers weren't always welcomed by the town.
The local people who were already here, there were lots of battles over all sorts of questions. Well, about the logging question was one, but also just the way people behaved. They didn't live in a conservative rural way. They came from the city and, you know, were extolling a whole value system that was quite different. And there were some rowdy meetings in Bellingen to sort of, this is back in the days of the hippies, to get the hippies out of town. And
despite their differences, and perhaps out of necessity, Bellingen's many demographics began to cooperate over time.
Welcome to Bello, the Shire of Trees. People with hallows and hugs you need. Welcome to Bello and its dairy herds, its hard-working loggers and computer nerds.
I'm sitting on the bank of the Bellinger as it flows adjacent to the town. From my vantage point, I see the Lavender Bridge, the calm waters narrowing between the trees and, into the distance, the mountains of the Dorrigo Plateau. Up there lies a sheltered world of deep greenery, glassy streams and falls. This undisturbed beauty has been honoured with place names such as the Promised Land and the Never Never, and is home to journalist George Negus, concert pianist David Helfgott, and the Bellinger River snapping turtle, all three found nowhere else in the world. Sitting next to me, also appreciating the view, is Ben Perham. Ben is a resident of nearby Thora and a stage manager by trade. He's worked on sets for Soundwave, Big Day Out, and Bluesfest, and fell under Bellingen's spell 13 years ago when his camper broke down during a long weekend.
When I arrived here, I was on a journey to sort of head around Oz, and in 2006, when I finally grounded, and this was my first stop, I thought I'd stop in here for a little bit, and the camper hasn't moved in 10 years.
What kept you here?
The river, actually. Something changed for me as a soul, more about just being able to sit by the riverside. It's the nature of the place drew me, and then the people within the community absolutely astounded me how much cross-section there could be. I grew up in
The unlikely harmony between Bellingen's many groups that Ross saw the beginnings of was well established by the time Ben settled here. By then, it was being reflected in the entertainment scene, as local Marty Guy explained.
It's a crazy little town. You can go out every night of the week if you wanted to. With Bellingen and festivals. Did you hear of the global festival that they had for 25 years?
Since the early 90s, Bellingen has played host to the Global Music Festival, the Jazz Festival, River Festival, and Classical Festival, all locally run, attracting internationally renowned acts, and often turning the post office, youth hub, and golf club into pop-up venues. Ben's helped organise most of these festivals, and he's impressed with how well people understand festival culture in the town. When the festivals aren't on, four dedicated live performance venues cater to, and are sustained by, the diverse demands of the local audience.
But at any given venue, there's a few locals that don't seem to need to buy a ticket. And that's just the way it goes. You know, they just walk straight through the door. You don't even bother to stop them. And, you know, it's because it's the way, you know, those venues run every other day of the year.
held up by the locals, to be fair, you know, so it's a fine balance to find.
It does seem cool, though, that every group in this town almost has their building.
Yeah, in a way,
And they're trailblazers.
And look, it's a generalist statement. I don't want to get caught on you know, trying to generalise this community in any way, because they're far from it. But there is a whole, cross-section, and there's something for everyone. And I think that's...
Perhaps unsurprisingly, Bellingen's individual character has bred pride in locals, who have been compelled to channel this pride into the written word. The poems you've heard throughout this story are by the Bellow Bards, locals who have been coming to poetry evenings Marty's been putting on in the town. Marty's originally from New Zealand and, like Ben, discovered Bellingen 30 years ago.
And then came back and had the opportunity, into books, and opened a little bookshop in Bellingen, the Bella Book Cafe. And that's how the poetry started on the last Friday of the month.
With the impetus of a local student, Marty's Cafe became a venue for poets in 2007.
And we had some fabulous poets come out of the woodwork. It was amazing. It really was a time.
Some of those who showed up to poetry nights wrote about their surroundings, and a dozen or so of those most dedicated to this cause came to be known as the Bellow Bards. More recently, the Bard's works have been compiled in the book From Bellingen with Love. I'm beginning to sense there's a rhythm to life in this town. Bellingen's unique, and this attracts wanderers who happen upon it. When they settle, they add their own uniqueness to the mix, further growing the town's appeal. But Bellingen faces a fight to retain its individual character, on a number of fronts. This hit home in February 2015, when it was learnt a mysterious disease with a 100% mortality rate was affecting the snapping turtles, that species found nowhere else in the world. Hundreds of turtles were found either sick or dead, their bodies washing up on the banks of the Bellinger. Even now, the cause is unknown. Marty has noticed other portents of change.
Well, I do see a change. Yeah, I see a change because there's a lot of estates being put in, you know, around the edges. We've got logging coming in. There's so many trucks go through the town every day, like 20 to 30 trucks come down from Dorigo, because that's the main road, the main drag, down Waterfall Way. And, that's happening. All the trees, there's been protests about cutting down old forests.
And Ben says even the proud festival scene has started to be undermined. The Jazz, Global and River Fests have all closed down in the past 2 years, driven out by more commercial festivals that have set up shop in town.
The Jazz Festival is finished now, so whatever, we, you know, turn the page and we move forward. But, you know, I do see it as a shame, if nothing else, and I'm disappointed that local suppliers don't get engaged when those opportunities arise. Main reason why it folded was because there was a dedicated team for 25 years who retired. They were in their 70s. They left it to me and two other people, decided to jump in and try to do our best. And it breaks my heart a little bit that we weren't able to, you know, keep an event like that and to evolve it and to bring it into the current format, you know, whatever it needed to do. There was already plenty of challenges with what we had to deal with against council and lack of funding and trying to find volunteers, but the absolute breaking straw was just not being able to find a commercial standpoint against such a successful, and Mullum is a very successful, very successful.
Over the October long weekend, Ben tried to kill two birds with one stone and staged Turtle Fest. The 3 days' worth of music and events at Bellingen Showground was jointly aimed at raising awareness and funds towards efforts to save the snapping turtle and to establish a seed fund to bring back the River Fest next year. So, how likely is it that efforts to keep what's great about Bellingen alive will succeed? Will the Bellow Bard's memorable musings ultimately depict a town that exists only in the past? Perhaps the Byron Bay parallel will continue in the area. While the arts and performance scene still exists in Byron, the original migrants have largely dispersed to surrounding towns, as far west as Lismore, as holidaying families, developers, and money have moved in. But Ross doesn't believe Bellow is destined for the same fate, and not just because there are no beaches here.
I think people in Bellingen
would find the comparison with Byron Bay odious. That, I mean, sure, there are similarities, but I think Bellingen prefers to be a smaller. There's a lot of younger people too. That gives it a surprisingly high population of people in their 20s and 30s here.
Okay. And these people that are in their 20s and 30s now, I want to use a better word than indoctrinated, but do you think that they're advocates of the same lifestyle as the people that have moved here?
Yeah, I think they want nature. They have got that environmental and that artistic awareness for sure. I mean, it's a lot of music, still a lot of environmental work that goes on here too. So, yeah, I don't think it's ever going to go the way of Byron or something like that.
That story was by Alexander Darling with final sound design by Harry Demansky. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fiery is our SYN Production Manager. Michael Bryden is my co-host. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.